Good morning. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 5th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning, we have Kathy Anderson. Today's session number is ANK-2001-3. It's titled Working with Interpreters. Let's listen in.
Do a couple of housekeeping items and review what I've covered over the last couple of days around working with survivors of torture, and we'll talk about interpreters. So I'm Kathy Anderson, and I'm the Executive Director of Survivors of Torture International, which is based in San Diego, and also one of the co-founders. And prior to doing this, I've resettled refugees, and I've been in private practice as a counselor, and I've had to use interpreters from time to time. I have some materials with me, some brochures from my own organization that I'm happy to pass out. I also brought this booklet with me. It describes torture, the extent of torture, the definition of torture, the effects of torture. I think it's in a very well-written way. And so it's a free publication put out by our Department of Justice. It came out just last year. You're welcome to take a look at it, and if you're interested in getting a copy, you can call them. It's a toll-free number. Write to them, get on the web, and access this publication. So I will pass that around too if you're at all interested. And in the back too, you'll notice on the last two pages are where treatment centers are throughout the country. And it surprises me that there isn't a formal treatment center in the Seattle area. There should be in the Puget Sound area, given the number of immigrants that are there. All of ours pretty much has started because of the vision of one or two persons. Three of us got together in San Diego and founded this organization. It's two pastors and myself. And some are fairly young, and some are older, different models, different approaches. We all support each other tremendously, even though we're separate organizations who do this kind of work throughout the country. So just a little plug, if you know somebody with some initiative and vision and feel a passion for this kind of work, there would be many of us who would like to help get something started in the Puget Sound area, because there is a need for it. Okay.
Do you have email on here?
I do. Is it on that first, on the very, let me take a look at that one.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's the last line in the box on the front.
Right.
Survivors at notorture.org.
Yeah.
Because I'll find out more about Carson's project at the University of Washington.
I would really like to know more about that. And maybe have them plug in. We have all the answers, but the field is so small. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to be able to share. I can tell you a little bit about the torture treatment centers, kind of bring you up to date a little bit. Doing this kind of work, there's more history to it in Europe. Torture treatment centers started cropping up, especially in Scandinavia and in Germany after World War II, which makes a lot of sense, and then in Canada after that, and then in the United States. But the field is pretty young here in the United States. The oldest center, formal organized center, is the one in Minnesota. That was in the mid-80s. And the oldest program where people were providing this kind of treatment, not necessarily in an organized way, but they had a lot of patients who were survivors of torture, is in Los Angeles in the early 80s. So the field is fairly new. However, it's very well researched. There's a journal that comes out of Copenhagen every other month with articles just on this subject. It's called Torture. The people who go into it, by and large, are pretty well educated. A lot of psychotherapists and physicians, clinically trained people who do this kind of work. So it's a horrible kind of thing to have to be doing, and I wish we didn't have to do this work. The flip side of it is that I'm glad we are doing it, because it wasn't done before, and people needed assistance. one of the co-founders of my organization is George Falk. George Falk is an ELCA pastor. He tells the story readily, so I'm not going to be breaking any confidentiality. He was raised in Hitler's Germany, and I did not know this until he shared this with me, that his father was a pastor, an SSI man. Gestapo routinely went into the churches and checked the content of the sermons, and if the pastors weren't preaching what Hitler and his men wanted, then they would be routinely brought up on charges around treason. And his father stuck to the gospel, did not stick to Hitler's gospel. And as a result, the SSI men would come into George Falk's home and put guns to the children's heads and make threats and steal some of their possessions, intimidate them, and terrorize the family. And eventually his father was imprisoned and was brought up on charges of treason. And they were going to proceed with the court proceedings, but it was getting closer to the end of the war and they needed him to fight instead. So they sent him to the front lines. And he was captured by England, and he was a POW. Apparently, he was one of the happiest POWs. captured by the Brits. And when he was returned home, the family was quite destitute. The mother was an American, so she was ostracized by the community, and there was really no way of providing for the family. So there was a lot of trauma that had occurred within the family. And as soon as that war ended, they moved to the United States. Now, George Falk at this point was a teenager, so he entered into San Diego High School. And something else I did not know, that some of the boys left high school, went to fight in the war, and they came back as men, veterans, and they went right back into the high schools with boys. They didn't go to adult school or college. So they did not like that George Falk, this German boy, was in the school. This is who they had been fighting. And gosh, so they routinely took him out to the back and stripped him and beat him up and teased him and worse. And the parents complained, but the district did nothing to protect the child. And you would not know he's from Germany. He said he got rid of his accent so fast in order to acclimate to our society. So that's his story. And he went on and went through seminary and raised a family. I think he's an incredible man. When you get to know him more personally, you find out that he only sleeps 4 hours a night because he has trained his body about into the fourth or fifth hours when he has his nightmares. And so he trains his body not to sleep more than 4 hours a night. And this is a man now in his 70s, and he says, I want this organization to be successful because I wish this were around when I was coming to the United States, because I would have really benefited from it. Mm-hmm. And he says, he's learned so much by being a part of this organization that he now has conversations with his children so that they can better understand their father. And there's some ahas now. So it's what's amazing to me is this is someone that you would least suspect to be a survivor of torture. And it wasn't torture in the normal sense of someone being incarcerated and having physical beatings or worse done, but certainly he was more traumatized as a young man and suffers the effects of it. And so I would submit to you that Seattle probably a lot more folks than you would even imagine. In your midst and maybe even in your congregations. Just as a quick review of last Monday and Tuesday, there are about 500,000 torture survivors now in the United States. These are direct victims of torture, and then there are many more indirect victims of torture, and those are their family members. About 100 countries currently practice torture right now, and about half of the world's population lives in those countries that practice torture. in San Diego, we have a high number of Middle Easterners, people from Iran and Iraq who live in San Diego. And the kind of torture that happens in those countries is indescribable. It's just horrible. Certainly a large number of Africans. We have many of the Lost Boys of Sudan. They've been getting quite a bit of press lately.
Lutheran Social Services has the emancipated minors, those older children that come and that must have to have
exactly.
Lutheran Social Services in Seattle. How many Lutheran Social Service sites accept emancipated minors? Do you know?
I don't know.
It's so strong in Seattle.
Yeah, and I know that LIRS is very interested in tapping more into the torture treatment rehabilitation movement, and they've been trying to secure funds from the federal government in order to do that. Mm-hmm. But at this point, there hasn't been an organized effort on the Lutheran front. I think it will.
Certainly.
Yeah. Let's see. And also in our part of the country, we too have many Latinos, certainly many Mexicans and Central Americans. The ones that we have seen who've been tortured because they're homosexuals, and the police departments have no tolerance for that. And they are quite brutal towards these people to the point of death. So that's why we've seen various Mexican survivors of torture. I also talked the other day about the effects of torture, and there are both physical effects and psychological effects. The physical scars are usually more easy. It's easier to heal physical effects or psychological effects. Those leave lifetime scars, and those are harder to heal. And there are a variety of reasons for that. We went into it more on Tuesday. But what you'll notice oftentimes with people is that they're presenting with a variety of things. Depression, certainly. Sometimes they're suicidal. A lot of anger, numbness around emotions, not being emotionally available to other people. I'm going to be missing a lot off the top of my mind here. Easily agitated, irritable. Hypervigilant, which means you're always kind of looking over their shoulders, which makes a lot of sense. We call it a startled reaction response. They hear a car backfire, they hear a helicopter, and the reaction is much more intense than it is for us. Sometimes it sends them into flashbacks, certainly a lot more nightmares, night terrors, night sweats. As a result, a lot of insomnia.
Adrenaline staying on and all the effects of that.
Right.
Not being able to quit moving. And children just can't physically sit still.
That's exactly right. And physiologically, what happens when people are feeling these sorts of emotions? And we are having a much better understanding of how we can't separate psychology from our physical health and how it's all interconnected. Research has shown that Cambodian women have five times a higher rate of strokes and heart disease at a much earlier age than the general population. And we're suspecting it's the same sort of thing where the atrocities that they went through, the killing fields and having to bury their children one after another, and then increased childbearing and trying to replace the children that they lost, not talking about it. There's even in Long Beach documented, I don't remember what it's called, some kind of blindness, where physiologically there's no evidence of it, but they truly cannot see anymore. They cannot see anymore because they've seen so much. So those are the kinds of clients who we work with and who I know are in Seattle area. And I also talked a little bit on Tuesday about what can we do. And there are a variety of things that we can do to help people. But I think bottom line, that I can't stress enough, is that torturers tell people that humans are bad. They not only tell them, they exhibit it, that humans are bad. Mankind, it's despicable, you can't trust each other. And if you tell your story, no one's going to believe you. And so if somebody does tell the story, to believe them, give them that benefit of the doubt. And secondly, to offer some support to them, to start building that trust, just as one person being good to another person. And this is not highfalutin psychotherapy, it's just human kindness that, you know, our Lord asks us to do anyway. And for us to be just a little bit more vigilant around that when we're survivors of torture. And it can make a huge difference. I know that in our congregation, we every Sunday pray for survivors of torture. And on occasion, we have mentioned that in our sessions with people, that when appropriate, you know, we will say, you're being prayed for. And on a couple of occasions, people have cried, saying, oh my gosh, people are praying for me, stranger. It just goes beyond what they think is possible at this point in their lives. And it's very, very touching. So simply praying is just magnificent. Just beyond words.
Don't let your voice drop too far.
Oh, because I get so touched by it. And I remember those people's responses. Yeah. In fact, there was this one man who said, I want to cry, I want to cry. I see other people crying and I can't cry, I can't grieve because there was so much loss that he felt. And when we told him that people were praying for him, he actually began to cry.
Oh,
very powerful. Okay, so now moving on to working with interpreters. I'm kind of curious in terms of if there have been any successes or challenges or any issues that have come up with any of you in working with interpreters. And if not, I'll bring them up. There are plenty. Any that come to the surface?
Oh. I can think of times when you have a feeling like this is not, the difference in cultures needs to be interpreted as well as the words need to be interpreted, but that when the interpreter is putting their individual opinion so strongly into the situation that, and then you say to the interpreter, you can't do that, and then you see them stop doing that, that's a nice outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, I think ideally in working with interpreters, and this is in the ideal world, and I know this isn't always possible, but ideally to find someone who not only knows the language, but who is a qualified interpreter. For example, I speak English. I don't think I would be very qualified to teach an English course at college level, let alone high school level. So simply because someone knows another language doesn't necessarily mean that they are the best interpreter. And I know for a while I worked in a hospital, and they would always bring the housekeeping staff to interpret. And these are highly technical words. Most of the house cleaning staff had never been to school in their own language, let alone in English. And unreasonably, they were being asked to translate emotions and, or interpret emotions and medical language, and sometimes words in another country. Maybe they know Spanish, but every country has its own little jargons. And it was, by and large, pretty unsuccessful. So I think the first thing to do is to find someone who's qualified. Now, oftentimes I think Americans assume that it's better to find someone from one's own culture because they know the idiosyncrasies of that culture. But in working at least with survivors of torture, we have found that oftentimes it's not a good idea to do that. Because these people, what they've experienced, are so embarrassed about. Men and women have been raped, both, and they don't want to talk about it. And we know it's healing for them to eventually to be able to talk about it. To talk about it in front of somebody from their own culture oftentimes brings so much shame that then they're not willing to do that. And the politics oftentimes is so intense in some of these countries that they're never quite sure politically where that interpreter is at. And so ideally, if you can find an interpreter who is not from that culture, it works better. Granted, you don't have the cultural nuance, they don't have the knowledge of cultural nuances, but the trade-off, I think, it's better to work with, let's say, a former Peace Corps volunteer who's been in that country, knows the language, a former missionary, university student or professor who knows the language. I think there are lots of possibilities. It requires a little bit more creativity, but I think there are some possibilities there. A good rule of thumb is prior to using an interpreter to spend 10-15 minutes with that interpreter before the session and tell that interpreter what your expectations are, what you're hoping to get out of that session, or what you're going to want to convey if it's just a brief, encounter. And to get a feel for that interpreter in terms of how well prepared they are. I think doing that little piece of homework can make a world of difference if we're actually working with the client and interpreter and yourself. Setting some ground rules, for example, like please only interpret what I say. Please do not add your own opinions. Setting some of the necessary rules for that session, I think, would be very important. When you're actually in the session, it's best to work as if you're in a triangle position, or if not in a triangle position, trying to figure out how to say this so that people on the tape can hear this, but you have a triangle, but the interpreter is a little bit further behind the client, and then you look directly to that person, that client, not to the interpreter, because the session is with the client, not the interpreter. And it's really hard to break that habit. Naturally, you want to talk to the person you're talking with, but you need to remember to use your eye contact with that person who you're working with, not the interpreter. Now, every culture is a little bit different. With Latinos, eye contact is good. Gesturing is good. Even touching them appropriately is good. Working with Asians, many of them, eye contact, direct eye contact is not good. So to do a little homework beforehand with the interpreter in terms of what they know, you should know. It's also a good idea. So it's a sharing of information, not just you're telling what you know. After a session with an interpreter, I think, and the client, it's good to spend a little time with that interpreter. It's very easy in our tight schedules to say, thank you, bye-bye, and instead spend 5 or 10 minutes and say what worked, what didn't work, how did that feel, this seemed to be most effective, maybe we try it this way differently next time, and do a little debriefing. Now, when working with survivors of torture, that's the technical part of interpreting, but we spend about the same amount of time as the client was in session, again with the interpreter, so it's pretty intense because this interpreter has now heard a story that they weren't oftentimes prepared to hear, and they don't know what to do with their feelings around that. And it's extremely helpful for them to be able to debrief with the professional in the room. It's very time consuming. First, interpreting in itself takes a long time. It's amazing. English, as you know, is a very precise language. It's pretty scientific. we're the ones, by and large, are on this forefront of the information age. We're the ones that need to create words almost on a daily basis around computers, for example. That's not the case in many other cultures. And their language tends, and especially in Spanish, tends to be much more feeling-oriented. It's very romantic. It's not quite as precise. In fact, research has shown that it takes Spanish-speaking people 40% longer to say the same things that we're saying in English. 40%. And I think it's also a reflection, our language is a reflection of our society. We're very time-oriented. We're very much hurried. We find the right words. We value being articulate. We're, you know, many times we're like, what is that right word? I mean, that is very common for us in our culture.
Yeah.
I don't hear that a lot, and I don't know about you, but I don't hear that a lot with Latinos. What is that right word? They'll talk and they'll express, and it's beautiful. But it's a different value system with that culture. And so it just takes a lot longer to say what we're trying to convey from English to Spanish. And then you've got the double time because it's in two languages. And then if you want to spend some time beforehand and some time afterwards, you can see how intensive this is. And for people who don't work with people of other cultures very much, I think it's a surprise. They think they're going to come in and just ask someone to interpret exactly what they said, and they're going to be done, and that'll be it. And it normally does not work that way. And then people start feeling frustrated because their expectations aren't met. And so I think it's necessary to shift those expectations a little bit.
And also interpreting with multiple cultures that are present, African American, Asian, and can get so complex, so multi-level.
That's right.
And then to try as the professional or the interpreter to rein it back in is a cultural thing that you're doing too. So it is so delicate sometimes.
Yeah. I think it takes great navigation skills, great people skills, great technical skills. This is my opinion, that so many of us in this country don't know a second language, so we don't really understand the depth and the intensity around knowing a second language, and we just kind of take it for granted when someone knows a second language. My husband works for Kemper Insurance, and it was wonderful because he speaks Spanish, and instead of just saying, oh, you speak Spanish, fine, they said, okay, we want you to take a test, and they contract with a company in New York City, and those folks called him, and he was on the phone for 2 hours proving that he speaks Spanish, and then as a result, they give him a 10% pay differential.
Oh, that's nice.
Isn't that nice? Because it is an added skill that he uses in his job, and it's not just taken for granted, but he had to prove himself too, and I think that's right. That would be for me, but
I always think it's funny when you're speaking with someone, about 10 minutes goes by and they say, could you speak to me in Spanish? And you just have do you speak Spanish? Yeah, we've just been speaking in Spanish. you get used to switch back and forth and to make the verb order and the adjective order correct, and so it sounds like English Spanish because of you in a hurry.
And there are idiosyncrasies amongst the different countries in Latin America. You know, I'm spending more time on that because that seemed to be the questions that came up this morning. My husband's from Puerto Rico, and we were in a grocery store, and we were trying to find the tortillas, and he asked one of the clerks who was Mexican where the tortillas were, and the clerk didn't know. So we eventually found them, and then he was, you know, a good guy, and went back to the clerk and said, just for your information, so when other people ask you, you know where they are, and they're in La Nevera. And the Mexican man looked at my husband and said,
Yeah. And I said, la refrigeradora. Oh, la refrigeradora. And then he looked at me like, why is that? Why is he understanding me and not the Latino husband? And what my husband was saying was icebox. Because that's what they call it in Puerto Rico. Oh. And we say refrigerator in both United States and Mexico. So little distinctions there. Let me go through a couple of do's and don'ts. I think one of the worst, again, perfect world kind of thing, but one of the worst things to do is to ask a close friend or a relative to interpret when the issue is a sensitive issue. Because, again, it's so shameful oftentimes, the experiences these people have gone to, they're most likely not to convey really what they went through or how they're feeling about it. And so just to be aware of who that interpreter is in the relationship. And then another common thing that I see is that the children learn English so quickly in the schools, and then they become the interpreters. And that's a double whammy, because not only are the parents less likely to reveal what's really going on with them in front of their children, but also then you have a real role reversal where the control is with the children. And in these traditional societies, it's hard on them to have to rely on their children so much. Now, they may not have the language to express that, but truly that's what's going on. And I've worked with a lot of Latinos who are afraid to go to the schools because they can't speak English. And then the first things the teachers do is they pull the children to translate. And yet the parents are there to talk about their children, and yet they don't want to shame the children don't want to shame the parents. And so it's just better to stay home than to go and try to have a conversation with the teacher. So to be aware of how we use the children as interpreters, more often than not, it's not appropriate. I've covered so many of this stuff already. Let's see. I think obviously when one of the ground rules is to state that everything that's spoken is confidential too, and that it isn't to be shared within the greater community. And I think that's something that we may understand, but we can't assume that that's a cultural assumption in other cultures, and to clearly state that. I think it's also important to speak in a normal, not overly loud voice. Oftentimes people confuse an ability to understand English as an ability to hear, period. That's not the case. And to be careful about how we use our words, not to use a lot of jargon and idioms and slang. What comes so naturally for us is very confusing for most foreigners. I was fortunate that I grew up with my mother as an English as a second language teacher. Mm-hmm. So I learned from very early on, and she brought many, many foreigners into the house, what was understood and what wasn't understood. I remember when, as a little girl, going out in the backyard and coming in, and I was all excited about finding a caterpillar. And there was a Bolivian man in our living room. And the look on his face, caterpillar. So I'm trying to explain the caterpillar and how it's going to grow into a butterfly. Well, the only caterpillar he knew was the big machinery. Oh, he couldn't figure out how that was in the backyard, let alone turn into a butterfly. So for us not to only be careful with our jargon and our slang, but also when we use our words in this language and the double, sometimes triple meanings that we have. Also, I think it's important to speak in very short sentences or concepts before you ask the interpreter to interpret. It is hard to recall that information. At least it is for me, and I think for most people. I don't know if you want to add to that.
What?
I found a length of speech that's a good rhythm, but I was wondering from your broader experience, what a minute and a half of speech, or if there's a unit that you found.
Well, usually I talk with the interpreter beforehand, and I ask them what they're comfortable with, given, you know, all these languages and cultures are so different. And sometimes that length, sometimes longer, and sometimes shorter. But I try to check in with them a little bit to find out. The other thing, too, to watch is if we start asking questions, one question at a time. Because it gets very confusing what they're answering to what questions. So to be aware of that. And sometimes as they're talking to us, they may ask a question, and it's so important to not say, oh, we'll talk about that later, and never get to it. Mm-hmm. That's terrible. So for me, I've learned with my short-term memory just to answer the question straight away, even though it may change the order of how I was trying to do things. I don't know if you've encountered that as well. But, yeah. It also builds trust, too. I don't expect the interpreters to be perfect, and I expect them to need clarification from time to time, or sometimes they may get confused. And again, that's something to acknowledge in the beginning of the session with them, and to allow them permission to ask for clarification, to ask questions, to tell them we know that this is a hard job. Because some of these people, you know, they're very proud of the work that they're doing, and they would be embarrassed to say, gosh, you know, I got confused or mixed up. And so to give them permission for that, I have found to be very helpful. Oh, the other thing too, and I maybe because I've worked in a hospital setting and I've been an interpreter for lots of different things. When there's something that's really important, for example, directions on how to take medications, or there's some kind of hazardous material, or something to understand about firearms, I always make sure that we double check to make sure that that is being understood. Have them repeat back to the interpreter, have the interpreter repeat back word for word pretty much what was being said to me. So I have what we call double back translation, or double back interpreting. And that's another thing to clarify too. Translation means changing the written word, and interpreting is the spoken word. So I hear that mixed up an awful lot. So some real kind of basics around do's and don'ts of interpreting. Any questions at this point? There's some really good videos. In fact, there's a good video, which I did not bring, but there's a good video that was made in Seattle. And there's an organization that deals primarily with Asians in Seattle. So,
Asian Counseling Service.
Yes.
Or Refugee Women's Alliance.
Asian Counseling Service is where I got the video. I don't think they actually made it. But that's where I got it. In fact, it was made at the University of Boston, Massachusetts. But I got it out of Seattle. And it's wonderful, because it shows typical interpreting sessions that go horribly. And I think you learn more by people's mistakes sometimes. And then they show how it's done correctly.
Have you seen the one out of the University of Arizona, Tucson?
No.
Bureau of Primary Health Care sponsors Spanish language classes for medical professionals. And they have interpreting it in Spanish, do's and don'ts. videotape that's included in their week-long session, but I'm sure could be available separate. So you could be contacted through Bureau of Primary Health Care. And it also features counseling related to AIDS.
Oh, wonderful. Is that Tucson?
University, no, it's South. University of Arizona, Tucson, okay. Or Tempe. Okay. One of the T's.
Okay.
The Bureau of Primary Health Care sponsors.
Okay. So a new one also came out from Oregon as well, just like last year. And it's also quite good. And it's the same kind of thing where the do's and don'ts, and then seeing how people do it so poorly, and then how people do it really well. It's a typical kind of thing where they just, that the poorly one is, uh-oh, I've got someone who speaks another language. You grab anybody who can speak that other language, and the person can't say no to a person in authority and wants to be helpful, and they're thrown into a situation where they're really not prepared for, and all the mistakes that can arise out of that. And I've seen that many, many times. I don't think that's terribly far-fetched. And that reminded me when I was saying, you know, that people can't say no to authority. One of the first things I learned when working with different cultures is when we say okay, it means three different things. Mm-hmm. Okay, or nodding our head, means I hear you. That means I understand you, or it could mean I agree with you. So oftentimes when I was working with Asians, Vietnamese, Laotian, and Cambodians, I get a lot of money. So at first I thought, well, they all understand and everything's fine. And all they were saying is, you know, I respect you, I'm hearing you, but not necessarily I agree with you. And so it's always helpful to double check again, make sure that the language is matching the gestures, because there are different gestures for different cultures as well. We do, in the United States, we do this to come, right? Well, in Latin America, we do that to animals, not to people.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
See, now that's worth the whole price of admission.
Yeah.
Because when I take patients back to the exam room, it's viene con mi, por favor.
Oh,
viene con mi.
So this is for
bring
animals.
Bring your dog.
So how do you say
it's below.
In, as well as in Asia. In Japan, it's like, and what we're doing is making our hand go down versus go
up.
Our fingers aren't going towards us. Our fingers are going back and away.
Yes. Exactly. And if ever, you know, even just going through a border stop, if you go down to Southern California or Southern Arizona, and you'll see the border guys, they're moving their hands like this. You don't see them going like this, because that's very rude. That's what one does to one's dog, not to another person.
Gosh, see, that's so nice. That's so nice to know.
Yes.
I'll spin a little bit of a yarn. We went on an elder hostel some years back, and we're in Madrid. And of course, in an elder hostel, you get lectured. You get a bunch of lectures and so forth about the country, the trade, the products they make, and the history, and all the things. So they provided, there was one man who was a man and his wife. They were both professors in the university there. And the man also was a lawyer, and they were good speakers and everything. But it was very difficult to figure out. They were speaking to us in English. Uh-huh. And when they spoke to us in English, we had Spanish syntax. Mm-hmm. So we can't figure out what they're talking about half the time. See? And these are professors of English. They teach it.
What do you mean syntax?
That's the way they tip the words around.
The order.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The subject and the verbs and all that. Mm-hmm. And because he nailed something on the end of the sentence, and then, okay, what's that? You know? And it was, there were some other problems, but that was one of the things. Now, I'm sure that they'd say, oh, I can be an interpreter. I'm a professor of English, mm-hmm. and so forth. So it doesn't quite fit.
And so you can imagine if you needed to go to the hospital and a professor of English came with you and you were in distress and trying to tell the hospital staff what you needed, and yeah, here's this yeah, guy yeah, twisting yeah, stuff yeah. around, it would add to yeah. your distress.
Well, you know, in kind of in the same relation, when we speak in English, our verbal communications are comparatively abrupt. And there's a few countries that have as an abrupt way of conveying, for instance, like Denmark. They're quite, they're very, what? Economical in the number of words they use for saying something. Mm-hmm. And you'll see a product made, it's in German, it's in Danish, say Swedish, Spanish, French, and all you gotta do is count how many lines of talk mm-hmm. is on there, and English is probably the best, the shortest,
uh-huh.
except in Denmark, it's about equal.
That's funny.
Yeah, that's yeah. the first time I've ever run into that.
Oh, that's so true, because I've
and some of it is twice, and some yeah. of it is 50%. Mm-hmm. In some Asian countries, they're quite abrupt.
Mm-hmm. And some not. And then, yeah. and there are some people who don't, you haven't been educated, they don't think in a linear way as we do, mm-hmm. and they yeah. talk in a circular way, mm-hmm. and that takes a lot longer to interpret. We are a very, just by the way we're educated and acculturated here in the United States, we think in a very linear, systematic way. Not that that's better or worse, but I know when we have a lot of Somalis in San Diego, it's a very oral-based culture.
I love it, the language, and especially one group of Somali language. So guttural, expressive, yes. happy. Yes. It's lovely.
And what it's amazing is that the word spreads so quickly in that community. If we're having a meeting, all we need to do is tell one person, and the next day 200 people will show up because they rely on their oral traditions
yeah.
so readily. Whereas for us, we write it out, photocopy flyers, we'd be worried about where to post them. It's a very different way of communicating. And then we forget, you know, put it on calendar and get it done. The Somalis, it's just amazing how they communicate verbally so easily. And that's how they get the word out. So it's all these things, it makes life really fun. But in a situation where you're working in a counseling session or in a hospital, it can also be real frustrating. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some good rules of thumb that can make it more effective, too. Okay. We're about there. Any last-minute questions? I have a son in Narnia that I try to get to straight away, so...
I have a question that may not be short, and that is the culture of Hell's Angels and how to identify of course you wait to tell somebody asks for help, but in domestic violence in any job you see a batch of something come through
mm-hmm.
And about a year ago, we had many young women that were trying to leave the Hells Angels, and that made me very puzzled of the how that culture is set up, and how hard it is, how hard they perceive it is to leave, and be able to have a free life.
I've never worked with that, so I don't know. The torture that I work with now, it's government-sanctioned, politically motivated torture. So I don't know. But, you know, this doesn't answer your question, but it brings to mind that violence was so prevalent in Guatemala for so many years, and there were so many men out of the home fighting in those war, in that war, that now 90% of Guatemalan women are victims of battery and of family abuse, domestic abuse. So apparently, I have a good friend of mine who goes to Guatemala every other week, and she teaches people on how to take care of themselves. She documents her at the United Nations. And she says it's not uncommon when you walk in the villages to see women just all beat up in their faces from what has happened over the years. And it's, or in Somalia, they don't really talk to each other about torture because not so much that it's so shameful, it's like, well, that happened to you, that happened to me, and it happened to everybody, so why even talk about it? So it doesn't answer your question, but it just reminds me of how in certain groups or in certain cultures that this way of life is just part and parcel with living. And I think we're called, you know, by God, not to, I guess I'm using the theme, but we are called to God to respond to these needs, to turn a blind eye. They're all around us. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure.